getting to 25 kind of means we never sweat. We never break a sweat. And you feel pretty comfortable. And yet when you hit an outlier with a power law, it truly can return the whole fund multiple times,
right,
or at least once. And then like a secondary can return 25% of the fund. That puts a huge injection of safety into everyone's bloodstream about the next fund, you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of like 25. Also, you know, whenever I get in my car, I'm like, who am I going to call? Who am I going to call? And, you know, one of my CEOs. And you know, get more than 25 and you got more than 3-4 funds that are kind of cooking companies, that's stressful. And it becomes questionable if you are a value add venture capitalist,
right,
to invest in. Another change we made, Brian, is trying to be a little more focused on the sectors. So there was a bunch of deals that we were doing that just wouldn't get done today because they're not kind of on thesis enough.
Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, we're delighted to have Andrew Romans on the program. He's a venture capitalist, author, educator, and he's the founder and managing partner for 7BC Ventures. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Brian, great to see you. This will be fun.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this one for a while. Thanks for so much. Would love to get an intro from you for the audience.
Yeah, sure. I mean, my background was founder, venture-backed at 4 different companies, raised over $300 million of VC funding. So my early experience was being on the receiving or fundraising side of the venture table. And then I switched over and started my own fund. And I'm now investing out of Fund 4. And I was pretty psyched to see Brian Bell invest in one of our deals, Nada, just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
If we can, if that's not a secret.
Yeah, no, that's, Nada, I was really impressed by John Green. What an amazing personality and story. I mean, what a really interesting idea to allow people to borrow against their equity of their home without a payment. On a simple agreement. I just thought that was really impressive. And he's making these city funds and what a really cool co-investment. Maybe you could tell the audience why you invested in what you liked
sure.
about that deal.
So again, you know, awesome to see us co-investing and supporting the same startup together. We co-led that with Live Oak, and I've known Krishna from his AV Austin Ventures days. So not as a company, a startup based in Dallas, Texas. And they've got a two-sided marketplace where on the one side, homeowners can sell a home share. So rather than take out debt where you got payments and stuff hanging over your neck, you can sell a home share for like $50,000, $250,000. And you don't have to pay that back until either you sell your house or 10 years goes by. And the amount that you pay back is tied to the accretion or, you know, depreciation of the house price. They do come in with a discount, so it's pretty impossible for them to make practically contractually less than like 9.8%.
Right.
And you're not allowed to think of it this way, but I do think of it as APR. So you're basically getting 9.8 to 20% APR, although that's not what it is. Super securitized by, you know, owner-occupied properties in
right.
states that are going up like, you know, cities that are going up like crazy, like Nashville, you know, Miami, Austin, places like that. So on the one side, it makes total sense to get some cash out of your house and not have any obligations, send your kids to college, whatever. And on the other side, it's pretty dope to be able to make kind of like instead of private debt, fixed income, make 9.8 to 20% completely securitized by the U.S. housing market, owner occupied. And then it's a derivative yeah. like MBS mortgage-backed securities where
right.
they pull together like 150 of these home shares from Miami, 150 from Austin, and you know, we could use up the whole podcast talking about
yeah,
them,
it's such an interesting
just makes
concept.
A lot of sense.
Yeah,
it could be the
part
next
of what
SoFi.
Did it for me too is not only were you guys in the deal, but Tor Steen from CrowdStreet, where I'd made a ton of investments as an LP, and I was just a big fan of CrowdStreet and I've been following him for 10 years. He joined the board, and I was like, well, that's it. If Tor's in, I'm in.
Well, it's also he brings a lot of kind of magical secret voodoo to the mix that's not obvious to everybody. So we're excited to provision him in more and.
Yeah.
unlock, self-actualize what he can bring into the company.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was actually on the podcast. So for any listeners out there, I think it was just 2 episodes ago from this one. So
I'm definitely going to catch that. Cool.
Yeah. It'll be a good one to listen to. I don't think I've released it yet, but as of this recording, but maybe we could talk about some of the startups you raised money for and what those were and kind of how that informs your venture capital career.
Yeah. So in my career, it went from being the founder, raising money for my own startups to then VCs asking me to join the board of some of their startups after the dot-com crash, where I was technically fundraising like an investment banker. And then I created a venture capital equity exchange fund, which is before secondaries really were prominent or tolerated. You could swap some of your founder-backed stock into a pool, and I get 25 VC-backed founders in the same pool. Whenever there's an exit, all the founders get paid, and my management company was getting 20%. And after 15 years of doing that, we decided to get into very vanilla, straight up, no innovation on the legal structure, just 2 in 20 VC funding. So right now we're not fundraisers, we're allocators. And so we raise money from LPs into a 2 in 20 VC fund, investing now out of Fund 4, you know, investing in startups. As far as the type of startups, we look for companies with 100K to 500K monthly recurring revenue. Okay. So we're not doing super early. So if you annualize
seed and A kind of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I call it late seed and A, really.
Yeah.
You know, blurred
why that
lines.
Number, what over the last 10 years of investing that kind of informed that number? Because it sounds like a very specific number you'd like to see.
It is specific because I think that if you're investing in companies with pre-revenue or 5K revenue, like really early stage, you really need to follow in the steps of Ron Conway from SV Angel. And I remember sitting down with him to make an equity exchange fund many years ago with him in person. And he showed me an Excel spreadsheet with 240 companies in one fund. And yeah. I literally said, holy crap, that's insane. And I said, do you even know their names? You know, and you know, I've met his portfolio saying I met him 3 times and he introduced himself like not knowing me. And if you're in 240 companies or even more, and there's a new fund every 2.5 years, over 10, 20, 30 years, like my career, that's just too many to help. So, you know, if you have 100 kids, how good of a dad are you? You know what I mean? So now that's a
Genghis
great
Khan.
Thing.
You're Genghis Khan.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's a great thing. We need
you're the ruler.
I love working with these guys. Yeah. I'd like to be an LP in some of those funds and get even better optics to what's graduating to our 100K zone. But bottom line, you need a lot of diversification. On the flip side, when the companies get above 500K, so I was specific, annualized at 6 million, they're probably moving quickly even beyond that. And so at that point, you fall into the crosshairs of your $2.8 billion funds where imagine, Brian, you and I have a $1 billion fund and we have a new one every 2 years. And sometimes all we do is a 1.2X. So we end up delivering the billion that we raised with 200 million of profit. And it is what it is. Was that great for the pension fund endowment? They don't get paid either way. Don't really care. They're in every vintage. They've been with us for like 40 years. But we get 20% managed, you know, carry performance fee on that 200 million of profit. That's
a lot of
40
money.
Million bucks.
Yeah.
40 million bucks every 2 years for that kind of performance. When you get to that 6 million plus of revenue, you start getting into that territory of the growth market where a 2X would mean 200 million a carry.
Right.
And the punchline is they have a new fund every 2 years and they're bigger than a billion. So we love to work with those seed funds and we love to work with those, you know, crossover or multi-billion dollar 40-year-old dynasty funds and pass our nada over to them. Let them write a 35, 50, 75, $100 million check at super big valuations and watch our company graduate into that zone. And with inflation and startup pre-money valuations, we've started selling like 5% here, 10% there, 25% there when we're above a 10X on the secondary market. Yeah.
Wow.
And so, and think about this too, Brian. Companies are generally not selling more than 20% of the share capital in a late seed, which is what I would argue Series A used to be. And then they do 20% dilution in a Series A. We may see that go up for, you know, hardware companies in certain sectors, but that if you're in a hottie, tale of two cities, everyone wants to be in that one, they're not selling more than 20 because they know a year from now, they'll 4X revenue and sell only 10% at a much higher valuation. So what really ends up happening is when we enter, you know, late seed A, we expect 5 more funding rounds selling 10% each. That is 50% dilution to us.
Right.
Are we still making a 10, 20, 30, 40X return on our blended entry point investment?
Probably not.
We kind of need to, we kind of
need to trim in each round 5 or 10%. So that's become the strategy. And by the time you got to fund four, you look back at some of the returns in prior funds, you're like, you know what? If I would have just trimmed, I could have.
You mean sold a little bit?
Yeah.
Sold a bit earlier?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. 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 I mean, I was trying to do that the whole time. But if you're investing
in series
B
kind of range, series B, C.
Usually it would be more of the C, you know, also the company's kind of linearly growing top line revenue, but the valuation's growing like more of a hockey stick. So for example, if you think about it, like, we're in a $3.5 million round, we're in a $7.5 million round, that's late seed and A. You know, maybe the A is even 12, 15 these days. And then the B round comes along and that's like maybe 19, 25.
Yeah.
And then the C round comes and you're like, okay. So it's 25 yeah, it's like, million.
That's a lot of capital. Not sure how much more of this is going to grow. I got the 50X on this thing or the 30X, whatever it is. And now it's time to kind of trim 10 or 20% of this.
Yeah. I've got a company right now. We've been in the deal for 8 years. We were in it like, 9.5. 12 and a half post to 14. And now they're raising 25 on 225.
Wow.
And it comes out as a 10X plus, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
And the, if I had an opportunity growth fund, I would be investing now thinking I'm going to make a 3X to 4X and it won't take that long. So if you have a lot of zeros on the end of your fund size, it's a good investment now. It kind of feels like a kick in the nuts to sell anything right now, but a lot of my LPs are real people,
Yeah.
They're not in
like to see the distributions, care. Right? Now you trim this thing. Hey, I sold 20% of a 10X and now I'm returning some capital. We got some capital back in and LPs feel good about that. And when you go to raise fund five, now they're like, yeah, I'm getting some distributions for Andrew. This is
spousal
working.
Spousal approval. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a whole different game. I mean, just saying send me money. And I show you numbers and, Canva PowerPoint.
Look at my MOIC. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Multiple invested capital,
not the same as like, I jokingly say Jerry Maguire is like, show me the money. How about wire me the money?
Wire me the money. And the old joke in venture is that you can't eat MOIC, right? Like a MOIC sandwich doesn't taste very good.
Yeah, man, maybe someone can. Maybe they're using that to raise a big fund and they're eating food that they bought with their management fee. But the truth is the ultimate metric is DPI.
Yeah. So explain for the audience what DPI is and why that's important.
Yeah, so DPI. So the main kind of acronym measurements of VC fund performance, you can kind of think of like cash on cash returns. So if I put in $100,000, did I get $1 million back? Did I get just my $150K back? What did I get back?
Yeah.
And then there's was it worth the wait and how long did it take?
Liquidity risk is what that's called.
It can
called.
Be pretty cool to make like really alpha returns, but how long did it take? That might be very suitable for someone to invest out of the retirement account because they weren't going to touch that. So they were 59 and a half for later.
Yep.
But if you could have been in something liquid, what's right for you? So the big ones are TVPI, which is total value to paid in, which considers the multiple on invested capital, but bake back in management fee that you could argue was leaking out of the fund.
Right.
Multiple on invested capital or MOIC or MOIC, I've heard both, that's just measuring the multiple on the invested capital. That's ignoring, did you have a enormous, 2.8% annual management fee or a 2% management fee or no management fee? Usually it's 2 and 20, and then internal rate of return IRR is considering, if you invested on a Monday and it went up by Tuesday, your IRR is through the roof. That considers in a short period of time, it's going up. Whereas if nothing is getting marked up in our fund, every 3 months, we're getting a worse and worse IRR. And then thank God someone goes up and it pumps the IRR up again. People wonder, why is the IRR going down? It's like, well,
like a jagged line. Yeah.
It's like kids are getting older and so are you. Let's sell something and get and bump our IRR. DPI is distributions to paid in. And ultimately, when a fund is completely done and over, that TVPI or more, that TVPI will compress, and in the very end, TVPI will have equal DPI.
Yeah.
So DPI is the ultimate score. The problem is, if you're raising a fund every 2 or 3 years, it's hard to know as the LP or the VC how this is really going. There's a lot of directional arrows pointing up or down or sideways, but it's too long to wait for DPI. It's like you're a seed investor, Brian. Yeah. Someone will be
really
like, well,
pre-seed, mostly pre-seed, I'd call it too.
Okay, yeah. So pre-seed. So you're like, even if you have any, revenue numbers or user KPI numbers, you're like, does this go down at Christmas? Does it go up at Christmas? Does it fall off when kids are out of school? If you're waiting for this like Japanese data to study, you're going to miss the pre-seed opportunity.
Yeah.
And the big boys and the big valuations will take these low multiple fund performances.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. How has your investment philosophy shifted over four funds? I'm wondering, like, what did you do in fund one that's different from what you're doing in fund four? And how did that kind of change from fund to fund?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's different people can have different strategies. Everyone's unique. You know, your fund size is your strategy. A lot of people say that. I mean, I would say that I was much more excited about hardware being a Trojan horse for what was essentially a software company. We now generally avoid hardware companies.
Yeah,
hardware is hard. There's fewer VCs that'll follow on. So if you know, as you well know, I show my portfolio companies and we show our portfolio companies to hundreds and hundreds of VCs, right? Like, I'm glad you spoke to Mehran. He'll be showing you deals every quarter, hopefully, and vice versa. If you're into hardware, people are like, oh, we don't do that. We don't do that, you know?
Right.
So it's the hardware is something that we avoid. Now, that said, I used to have a slide that says, you know, investment framework rules 1 through 9. And rule 10 was break rules 1 through 9. And, you know,
in case of emergency, break rules 1 through 9.
Well, yeah, when you just know you would kill yourself for not making this investment.
I've run into that all the time. It doesn't fit the framework. It doesn't fit the thesis. And you're like, I'm going to invest anyway because I just have high conviction. Sometimes you just have to go with your gut.
Well, I mean, also, you see a lot of deals. I mean, you see, if you told people how many deals you actually see, they would be scared about working with you.
It's right on my slide, 500 plus. It's crazy. It's 20 a day.
You make some noise, start a newsletter, it'll get worse. So anyway, we invested in Umbra when it was pre-revenue, and they have a build of materials, so absolute
That's
hardware.
Interesting, because you don't typically invest pre-rev now. But so this is early, like fund one investment.
No. This is fund three. So we invested in a company that had a $4 billion bomb to build a satellite in Santa Barbara in Austin, Texas. They spend $1 million to SpaceX and insurance to put it in orbit.
Wow.
But they had two dev server, you know, satellites that I was able to play with from a laptop. And I was like, oh my God. They said, I'm on your next trip to Riyadh, show these photos and images of the hoodies that we're taking for you. Wow. And I was like, oh my God, this thing is going to sell out like crazy. And I won't disclose their revenues, but they now have 130 employees, many of whom are rocket scientists, and they're profitable.
Yeah. Wow.
So, I mean, that's a company that just like exploded, that broke the rules.
But, so what was it about that? Because that kind of, it broke the rules for you. Like,
I mean, you know, people is one. So I'd known Gabe for a long time. He's a Silicon Valley transplant to Austin like me. You know, he was the person who got me into the country club here. You know, we know each other for a long time.
Someday I might make that call to you. Yeah. I'm in Austin now, Andrew.
We'll say again?
No, I said someday. I was joking. Someday I'll probably make that call. Hey, Andrew, I'm in Austin now.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. It's a deal. So everybody I met, I really liked. And then they really let me play with controlling a satellite from a laptop where I was able to like zoom in, zoom out, all this kind of stuff.
So the tech was, the demo was amazing.
Well, yeah, they were demoing something that was not just like, oh yeah, this works. We just don't have anyone paying us for it. It was like, dude, I can make calls to NQTEL and the CIA and be your, like, I should quit my job and do sales for this company.
And, ooh, you know, I love that.
By the way, that I think is a great sanity check. Litmus so if test. Like Mehran and me are bringing you in and we're so excited and you're like, oh my God, these guys are drinking the Kool-Aid. I should throw some money in. Ask yourself this question before you wire. Would I want to quit my job and do sales for this company?
I love that.
Because sometimes you're like, well, yeah, it's a no-brainer. I mean, the Northrop Grumman satellite can take like 300 photos on one pass. We can take 10,000 and we can hear sound. We can go deeper. We can see through rain. It's so much better. And we're priced at 80% cheaper than them. Like, that's something you want to be a salesperson for. Other times you're like, all right, Eric Schmidt is in it. Mark Andreessen is in it. I'm all caught up on the Kool-Aid. But to be honest, this is a nice to have that anyone can do. And they're like, oh, they do it in Excel spreadsheets with SMS. I'm like, and I'll bet you they're going to always do it. They're not going to pay you for that license, you know? So it's kind of a good metric. Other thing that's changed a little bit was we were doing quite a bit of pre-seed in the early days.
Mm.
You know, I kind of feel like, well, anyway,
how has that shifted, right? Because early days, we're talking 2016, 17, 18, pre-seed meant a little bit different back then 8 years ago than it means now. How's that? That's also kind of shifted that definition.
I would say that when I was an entrepreneur, there were no Ron Conways doing three or four investments per week. They just did not exist. You know, and there was no list of angels on the internet like AngelList. So there was like kind of nowhere to go. You had to just network your balls off and, you know, call your ex-girlfriend and, you know, shoot anything you could do, you know? I think you then had these kind of Ron Conway guys. Then you had these, you know, the, you know, accelerator movement, boom. There was like 300 accelerators in the SF Bay Area from like zero to 300 in like 3 years when I was there. Yeah. And then you had kind of your Dave McClure types of saying, I'm terrified of losing money and making bad bets. So I'm going to diversify the hell out of this. And I'll take this fund size where there's impact. You know, so I think that there's a lot of seed funds out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes when there's like a market correction, the stock market drops like a knife and growth funding valuations drop like a knife. And there's a little bit of a delay for the like series B, C, D guys to work through their last valuation with VCs that don't want to mark it down. Mm-hmm. And there's like a lot of incentives to not mark it down. And then A comes down, late seed comes down, and it feels like pre-seed is the last come down. And there's these people that are maybe not so, didn't get the memo or don't think the stock market has anything to do with their stuff. And we're still competitively going into big valuation. So I think that pre-seed pricing is a bit high for me. And I kind of feel like, you know what? You're not giving me a lot of incentives here.
Yeah. Like, so high pre-seed price for you? Like what feels high? What feels right? What feels low?
I mean,
in 2024,
I'm a little bit of a grumpy old man, and I got to come and get real that there's been inflation at, you know, the grocery store, and there's inflation on exits as well. So
dollar doesn't get you what it used to, you know?
The truth is, like, AdMob would have sold for a lot more than $850 million today, right? And like, what was YouTube, like 1.2, 1.4 or something? That would have been a gazillion dollar exit today.
Yeah.
So I think, and you know, it's kind of like, if you remember Yahoo bought Flickr for photo sharing and YouTube bought Picasa, and Google had so much more traffic than Yahoo that they could have outbid Yahoo by like 20x and still made money, and it was accretive.
Yeah.
Whereas Yahoo only had its traffic that it's got. They could only pay so much and barely justify this could be accretive and we're going to make money on this acquisition. Now you've got like these multi-trillion dollar companies that are buying companies that they can afford for 1% of their, you know, market share. You know, think of Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion pre-revenue. Right. And, you know, months after being launched. And it was only 1% of their market cap to stop my wife. Back then, like Sunday morning, she'd wake up and look at the photos from the barbecue on Facebook. She could have very easily started looking at the barbecue on Twitter, and they were going to get sold to Twitter. And like Zuck bought it for $1 billion just to deep six it and stop photos from leaving Facebook and going there.
Right.
So these market caps that we have now are so big that you could justify something like this.
Yeah.
Whether it was like a straight up photo sharing or if it was a strategic, I have to bury it and deep six it and stop it from going to somebody else, that right. I think that you can justify some inflation. But a short answer to your question, I love
the long answer, by the way. That was great.
I love a 4.5 million post-money safe.
Yeah.
On something really early.
Yeah.
And but
early, like what? Like how much revenue, monthly, annual?
Well, 4 million is probably like nothing to, you know, some validation revenue. I made an investment on
20K MRR kind of thing.
Yeah, I invested in a company that like when it was like 240 ARR, 240K at a 4.5 million post money safe.
That's a decent deal. Yeah.
Right. And I thought to myself, I can sell this company for more than $5 million. So I feel like I've got, it's like, imagine you could buy Bitcoin 100 times at, you know, $100. And the worst thing that happens is you lose $100, which is not much for your fund.
Right.
And it could go up like Bitcoin. So like, I also thought it would be a fun one to support and we could really help it. But I think it's pretty common to see 12 to 15 as like a cap on a note or a post money safe.
That's pretty expensive for pre-seed, I'd say. That's well, a lot.
I don't know. I see him. I mean, if the team is sold
that
their
does
last
feel a
company,
little high. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy
more like
to hear
seed
you say
round
that
kind of territory to me, or maybe like a YC seed, which is really a YC pre-seed is 12 to 15, 20 caps, you know, hey, we pivoted 5 weeks ago and now we're raising 20. on a 20, you know.
I have to say, like, you know, I went through, I mean, you probably did. I mean, it feels like just yesterday that we went through this latest batch of YC companies. And, yeah. you know, if you do the math like this, like, so let's say it's a pre-seed of 20 million. So like, think of it as a pre-money valuation of 20 million.
Yeah.
And you've got to get liquid at 200 million to make a 10X return. Yeah. And when you're investing pre-seed, you kind of hope this is could be a 54X in a 32X in a 25X, right. which we've had. And those early, you know, big returns really carry a fund and make up for a lot of losses, right?
Yeah.
That, but you figure there's going to be minimum 50% dilution if you're in that early. So if you're in it at 20 million pre, you now got to exit not at 200, but at 400. That starts looking like 500 million. You know, how many companies really want to buy that thing for 500 million? And you've got a lot of time for the IRR thing that, you know, time is factored into this and the risk from getting to point A to point B. So anyway, we're kind of happy to settle on 100K to 500K MRR. It's a lot more work. I think if you show up at a good accelerator like Alchemist and say, I'm ready to write 8 checks here and then, you know, be moving my pre-seed fund and be in good company and co-investing with cool people, you know, most people will take your check. You've got a value add story. We all do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can get in. Try to get into a company with 1.2 million annual, 100K to 6 million annual revenue, and it's 4Xing revenue. It's, you know, you got to be helping a lot of people before they get to that point.
Yeah.
You know, it's work.
That makes sense. It is work. And then, so how's the, you talked a little bit about how the strategy changed from fund to fund. Are you still making the same number of bets per fund? How has that shifted?
That's quite similar. So on, if you're really early, you want to be in like 300 companies. So the biggest mistake most angels make is they're like, hey, I'm actually diversified because I'm in 12 deals, but they were all different check sizes, like radically. Yeah. And it took 9 years to get there. I would say that is an F. Like if you were taking my class on venture capital, that's not a passing grade. That's an F. That is a bad, stupid lotto ticket, tax on the dumb use of money, you know? So you got to be really diversified there. If you're going, if you're Peter Thiel, you can be more concentrated where any one of these would have a huge impact. Whereas, you know, Ron Conway's got Facebook in his portfolio, but dragged down by so many. Small check, one of 500 checks. We like the number 25. I think 15 is kind of a magic number, but like Dave McClure, you can start getting pretty nervous when you start seeing a few of your, I had high conviction ships sinking down to the bottom of the ocean. You're like, oh my God, are we going to lose money here? And so getting to 25 kind of means we never sweat. We never break a sweat. And you feel pretty comfortable. And yet when you hit an outlier with a power law, it truly can return the whole fund multiple times or at least once. And then like a secondary can return 25% of the fund. That puts a huge injection of safety into everyone's bloodstream about the next fund, you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of like 25. Also, you know, whenever I get in my car, I'm like, who am I going to call? Who am I going to call? And, you know, one of my CEOs. And, you know, getting more than 25 and you got more than 3-4 funds that are kind of cooking companies, that's stressful. And it becomes questionable if you are a value add venture capitalist to invest in. Another change we made, Brian, is trying to be a little more focused on the sectors. So there was a bunch of deals that we were doing that just wouldn't get done today because they're not kind of on thesis enough, you know? And maybe that's a bit of a wave of natural language processing and the ability to API into so much data, you know, but you know, there's deals that we did that did really well that I just don't have the passion to be doing those kind of things now. And I think it's better to, and there's less synergies among the portfolio companies. If you get a little more focused, you start to like introduce John Green to Eric Menez and Jared Kessler, and those guys are like introducing each other to 600 million.
Up a critical mass, that network effect of network nodes in a particular niche or space or category.
That's right. And if you're you know, so we still would say we're generalists, but you know, if you look at the real framework, it's not so generalist. And when we put our CEOs in the same room, they get pretty excited about how they can help each other.
Yeah.
And that's increasing with constant with more focus.
And what areas are those, right? What sectors and geographies, all that stuff?
Well, so I think every sector is broken and that everything can be fixed. with software automation and API into more data. So basically, the primary thesis is investing in companies that are really software companies that are automating human workflows and leveraging data. So kind of like DocuSign, way better than PrintJam and waiting for the other guy to sign and send it back to you.
Yeah.
But what about the million other things that happen in a real estate buying and selling of a house? You know, like there's like, or what are the 90 things that happen to get a mortgage? Or how does the Home Depot read their 90,000 PDF contracts? One guy sells them the door, the other one sells them the hammer and the nails. Like, how many contracts do they have? You need NLP, natural language processing, to read that, you know? Right. And it's kind of like the Fortune 500. There's either going to be a beneficiary of this technological change or a victim of the technological change. We want to build portfolios of 25 companies per fund every 2 years that are servicing that technological change, you know, that shows someone's the winner or the loser.
Yeah, the Fortune 500 has more changeover than any point in history. And so the average tenure now, I think, is 5 years for a Fortune 500 company, which is absolutely crazy if you think about it.
What? You're saying that if some massive General Electric company is in the Fortune 500, that after 5 years, they're out of it?
Maybe it's 15 years, but it's a higher velocity of changeover than ever at any point in history. Because it used to be, you'd enter the Fortune 500 and you would just stay there for decades. And now that's been steadily creeping down, especially over the last 20, 30 years.
I've heard there's fewer companies, you know, that have a market cap above a certain amount. So there's basically fewer companies for publicly trading investors to even invest in because of consolidation. And with Sarbanes-Oxley, like, I remember one of my MBA buddies, Ken Eisner, founded varsitybooks.com, got on the NASDAQ, 330 million market cap, standing ovation, best entrepreneur in our class. 330 million sounds like a post-money valuation that the high school dropout from YC is not impressed by. You know, where the point here is that you went public in the olden days when you reach a certain point. After the dot-com crash, Sarbanes-Oxley, who wants to pay $6 million annual compliance and
maybe you can talk about Sarbanes-Oxley, what that was and how that impacted, you know, venture capital and IPOs and stuff.
So, you know, a lot of people went and threw money into IPOs of pre-revenue companies that just added dot-com to the end of their, you know, pets business or whatever in the late 90s. And then we had this smashing dot-com crash of the stock market where it all went to zero, like some bad crypto situation. And then the government and their infinite wisdom made it extremely expensive to IPO a company in the United States, where China has this robust capital markets where companies go public on the Shanghai, Shenzhen, Hong Kong Stock Exchange. They have a currency to buy companies. It's all very vibrant. Angels, VCs, founders get their money out. It's working quite well. Where here, it's very expensive and painful to go public on a big boy stock exchange here. And so the result is stay private longer is the go west young man mantra that we're living in this post-dot-com crash. And M&A is even under attack by regulators, which...
Yeah, with the whole Figma acquisition, I mean, they're basically just locking up that channel. And so you got to be thinking twice about backing companies that may, you know, be acquired by the incumbent hyperscaler conglomerates like Microsoft or Adobe.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole value chain of big fish eat small fish eat big fish eat small fish that ultimately can, you know, perhaps trickle up. But yeah, it starts to be IPO is the only option for, you know, some of these investments by the time they get to a certain size that regulators, you know, could scrutinize. But the bottom line is that companies stay private longer. And so what does that mean for founders? What does that mean for LPs? What does it mean for guys like us? For us, it means invest in companies that you think will go up in revenue and graduate to a much higher valuation. They're on a path to crystallize an IPO M&A exit that'll return 10x plus for the fund, net of fees, net of dilution. But there's an opportunity to maybe sell a little bit along the way as those valuations go up and function with DPI in a world of government imposed stay private forever stuff. And we've culturally adjusted and caught up. So you have secondary funds. You know, you've got a whole developed system of right of first refusal and ROFRs and SPVs and, you know, all kinds of stuff. We've positioned ourselves to be on the side of the table that benefits, that doesn't lose. in a world of getting Roford and all that jazz.
Yeah, that makes sense. So maybe we switch gears, talk about some of the books that you've written and published.
Thanks.
I have two in my notes. Yeah. Maybe you can tell us about when you wrote them, why you wrote them, and what they're about.
Yeah. So when I was running the Founders Club, the venture capital equity exchange fund where everyone was swapping equity, we were getting like a small percentage of the founder stock and then maybe the co-founder, maybe like half of the angels and stuff. So we ended up with a large portfolio. And so I was constantly, and the founders said like, Andrew, I trust you more than my VC because you've got common ordinary founder shares, not these preferred. You don't have to raise an X fund or any unnatural acts. So I trust your advice. And I was always telling stories of saying, well, I know a guy who did this, and I would tell the story of what somebody else did. And back then I was a bit more humorous than maybe I am now, careful to not get me too'd or I don't know, canceled. And so I was, you know, a combination of stories and humor, and people were saying every day, you should write a book, you should write a book.
Yeah.
So the first book was like a baby that had to come out. And so I like the title that the Chinese translation gave, Masters of Venture Capital, where there's like interviews with all these masters, like Tim Draper's kind of the first chapter, Pitch Johnson, Tim's dad, Bill Draper, a whole lot of founders, John Kraft, you know, founder of Pandora, where he failed to meet payroll 22 times before the IPO. Wow. Just so many good stories where there's a lesson learned. So there's no bragging about, and then I invested in Uber, boom. And then I invested in Google, boom. There's no actionable advice to help anybody, right? So this book was more of like, this is what somebody did. You could do the same thing. Like anybody could do this. This is a great hack, you know?
Yeah.
That was the first book. That's in like five languages. And that was a long time ago. And it was published by McGraw-Hill, which was not a great experience for me. And there's good things about them, but net-net, I wouldn't work with them again. And then so my second book was Masters of Corporate Venture Capital. So that's like 50 case studies with all the big CVCs, corporate venture capital firms like Intel Capital, Microsoft Ventures, now M12, you know, Salesforce Ventures. And that deeply examines like why it's so important for the Fortune 500 or any of these guys to benefit from technological change and not be victims of it. Yeah. And yet they're not trying to just make a financial return. They want to make a strategic return. And there's more conflicts of interest for these guys than there are for even a normal VC who's already full of them. And so it's a very complex topic and academically interesting to me. And how can I take one of your startups, my startups, and get them working with Verizon or AT&T or something and become, you know, a $1 billion company through this distribution channel or partnership or acquisition? You know, all this stuff is like very compelling to being successful in entrepreneurship and all that. So we've managed to position ourselves as experts and have this huge corporate network of knowing all these CFOs and CTOs and CEOs. That's like book two. Book three was Masters of Blockchain. And I'm hoping in the next few weeks to finish book four, which I've let it write itself over about 12 years, that if something happens, I'm like, does that deserve to be in the book or not? So it's kind of like a busy, full-up disco that we can't let anyone in until we let someone out. And so that's the way, like, that book has got 12 years of, are you good enough to come in? Because this is not like Napoleon's 10-volume set. This is a 200-page book to respect the reader's time. So that book is, I'm excited about. And, you know, there's never a good time to stop doing everything and finish your book.
It's so hard. I'm like 9 chapters into my book too. And I've petered out. I've just sort of like, I need to pick it back up. I just so busy with Team Ignite. I can't even find, how do you find the time? I mean, it's crazy.
Well, it started with like being on airplanes, you know, like, you know, I'm on an airplane for 12 hours or 12 and a half hours. It's like, okay, let me get some work done. Let me have some dinner. Then I'm going to go dive into explaining my view of convertible notes, you know, pre-money, post-money safes, priced rounds. Can we build governance into these things? Like I know you're king of a side letter. Like, how do you make up for all these problems? Of course you do. Of course you do.
MFN, baby.
But not everyone does. Not everyone does. So I think like I've met pre-seed investors who don't understand QSBS, you know, like
I barely understand it. Yeah.
Well,
maybe you can explain for our investors listening and for my edification again, because I keep hearing it. I'm like, what again? How does it work?
Okay. So I think it's essential for you to know this. The QSBS is Qualified Small Business Stock Exemption. So if you invest in an early stage, well, if you invest in a startup that is not like a law firm services business, so basically everything you and I invest in would qualify under that thing. The next thing is that it's got to have under $50 million on the balance sheet at the time that you invest, everything. Inclusive of the money wired. So we could wire $48 million in a $48 million financing round to a company with a $1 trillion pre-money valuation, but they have less than 2 million of smokestacks and laptops in there. So the balance sheet qualified for being QSBS qualifying under 50 million. Then if you hold the stock for 5 years and a day, which is often what happens to your power law, not an acqui-hire where all the economics went to the founder and they screwed us, that you pay zero tax on the gain of the greater of the first 10 million of gain or 10x your cost, what you paid for the stock. So if you invested $10 million and it took 5 years and it sells for a gazillion, you pay zero tax on the first 100 million of gain from that exit. And so you might pay long-term capital gains and everything above 100. And if you're investing in a relatively small size, nimble, high-performing fund, it's like 100% QSBS. If something sells and it's as S-corps, it flows right through to your U.S. tax-paying LP who's got a green card and lives in Dubai but still paying that tax. So any U.S. taxpayer benefits from being in a fund or direct investment into something that's QSBS.
And that includes syndicated deals and LLCs. That includes limited partnerships for funds. Because you get the tier one, it just flows through.
Yeah. Everything you just said is an S-corp. If it's a Angelus, it's S-corp. If it's your LLC or limited partnership or limited liability partnership, all S-corps.
Basically, your accountant needs to just check the QSBS worksheet box on your return and say, hey, this was a QSBS and it qualifies. And so no capital gains at the federal level.
We document in our investment memo that we've now verified with Gunderson, DLA Piper, big law firm. This is QSBS qualifying, stamp. Done. Then when we make the distribution and we track it all.
You do it at the distribution time when it exits?
No. We do this on the way in. So what matters is, was it QSBS qualifying when you made the investment? Then when there's a distribution and we're exiting either secondary or definitive exit for the company, and we're doing a cash distribution to our LPs, we say to them, and I even say it to like the Japanese, I have no idea if these guys happen to have it was in his daughter's name somehow, who's got a green card. Right. I just say, hey, flashing red lights. If you're a U.S. taxpayer, you pay zero tax on this distribution. That is dope.
Do you do it once? So if you invest in a safe, that's not when, is that when the clock starts ticking, or is it when it converts to a priced?
Well, this is an extremely interesting question. It's debatable. I've had two VCs from like Gunderson and Fenwick on my podcast going on the record on YouTube and all the podcast platforms saying that a safe definitely qualifies. Now,
it's supposed to be treated as non-participating preferred stock.
Well, yeah. Right? So if you invest in a company that qualifies for QSBS and you hold it for 5 years and a day, and you had bought a secondary, so let's say the round is oversubscribed, you funded it, and you're like, yo, Andrew, you know, I'm in this thing for 500K. If you want, you can buy 250K off of me at the same price. And I'm just happy to do you a favor, Andrew. Yeah. I'm like, Brian Bell, you're the best. Thank you so much. Now, if I bought that off of you, that is not primary issued stock where my investment
from the company. Yeah.
Went into the treasury of the company to fund jobs. So this is really job stuff, like Jobs Act. So the government says if you're funding jobs, then you shouldn't have to pay tax. That's an incentive for you to go work hard to raise money and let everyone benefit from job creation. We'll have payroll tax. There's a multiplier of them spending that money in this country. If you exit in under 5 years, you can roll it over. I think it's like 90 days to invest in something else that's QSBS. Wow. Okay. So if you held it for 1 year and you got a gain, you can invest in something else. And now you've only got 4 years to get to the end zone of pay no taxes. I personally think that there's no question that a convertible note, like a promissory note, is debt with a maturity date and an interest rate. And it does not qualify as purchasing primary issued stock. So we're always pushing people to convert the debt into equity with a bona fide trigger, just let's all agree and we want to switch this in at the cap or something. If you invest on a safe note, there's a strong argument to be made that it's not debt. There's no interest rate. There is no maturity date. There's no way to get your money back. And it's a simple agreement for future equity. It is equity. Someone else can make the argument that there was not issued stock that you bought.
Yeah, splitting hairs though. You know.
So the other thing is that you know, YC came out with a safe note like 7-9 years ago. Nobody paid attention for the first 2 years. We're really only in year seven of this.
Right.
So it's been 2 years of QSBS distributions and the courts have not adjudicated. So my advice is that when we make the distribution to you or we invest it on a safe note, put that money into some kind of marketable security, like the stock market or something. Be ready
for them to come after you just in case on taxes.
Yeah. And just hold that in a bank account that is super safe rather than pay the tax. And
at least 30% of it. Yeah.
If anyone ever comes after you, you liquidate that account and you start paying, you know, the IRS. But until then, why would you, when lawyers are saying a safe note is equity?
Yeah. You bought shares. Probably
that's a longer answer than anybody needed.
It's like buying an option. You bought interest in something and that's when the clock starts ticking. I think that totally makes sense. Why get it certified on the way in? I mean, for a high volume small shop like ours, that would be kind of too onerous to go in for all 100, 150 of our investments.
The thing to do is like, you know, we're expected to not just give capital to the founder, but give them advice and then help them be successful. And fundraising is not just a little minor skill in the algebra equation of being successful. It's a big thing. And so I tell founders, I explain to them what QSBS is, and I say, ask your lawyer, do we check all the boxes for QSBS? And you definitely do, because I'm telling you, you do. And then let them write it into the actual investment documents that this is QSBS qualifying. And I've not seen it in a safe, but we should ask
them
to do it.
Maybe as a side letter. Maybe as a side letter. You know, you kind of start certifying this is QS. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a cottage industry for consultants that'll say, I will give you a rubber stamp. So the key thing is to not prove that it's QSBS at the time that you're exiting. The key thing is to prove that it was QSBS on your entry point at the time that you invested.
Look, we have it in a side letter. The founder certified it that these things were true for the QSBS. And
the founder's motivated because the founder is incentivized to say to everybody, hey, invest in my company. And if it does hit like a moonshot, you don't even pay any tax on this puppy. On the first $10 million again. Give me that 25 paycheck.
Add it to all my side letters.
There you go.
I have pro rata, MFN, info rights, and warrants. And I don't always get the warrants. I don't always ask for those. Those are kind of onerous. But the other three I always ask for. And I don't always get them. So I have basically a 4-factorial version of all my side letters. So it's like, now I got to go add this QSBS certification to all of them. But anyway, thanks for that.
You're just helping the founder when you show them that. Yeah. It'll make it easier for them to raise money and get the cash in the door.
I love that. We're going to run out of time, but I wanted to talk about, you know, the growth of the fund over the years, like how large the funds were and when did you decide to bring on a team? Because I just, you briefly mentioned Mehran that I met right before this call randomly. Really impressive associate of yours that you met through my understanding is a course that you taught on venture.
He was one of my students at Chapman University. Yeah. I taught a class on venture.
That's amazing. And then, so you have this amazing associate. When did you start bringing on team members? How big was the fund? When did you know it was the right time? Asking for a friend.
We've had associates from our first fund. So our first normal fund, like more venture capital equity exchange fund was 2014. And, we've had a number of associates. With relatively small funds, they were getting offers that we couldn't counter, and that was really tough because you think this is going to be like generational transformation. I'm teaching them everything, and I am kind of an educator, so I love getting into the ins and outs of QSBS with somebody. But with the current fund, we're investing out of a $50 million fund, and we expect to hire two more associates this year.
Yep.
One in Austin, one in New York. Mehran, as you know, he's in San Francisco. I'm now in Austin. And we hope our next fund will be bigger so we can grow the team.
Yeah, I love that. When did you first hire? So like on fund one or fund two, how big were those? And did you hire associates? How many? Like, did you do it right away?
I can't disclose fund size for an agreement I've got with someone, but I can say that we had one associate the whole way at a minimum. There were times where someone got hired away and we had to replace them. So we've been a one associate shop. Right now, I think we've got budget for one in New York, one in Austin. New York, funny enough, is much more expensive than San Francisco. but it's also expensive to like fly there, stay in hotels and all that jazz. You know, I don't mind going, but it's our number two market. And so I don't want to lose momentum. Another thing we've done is we've started a scout program, which I was afraid of doing it because of the emails that would come in. And we've received more applicants than I've been able to open the emails for yet. But, you know, we look like we're going to have like 25 scouts in that program.
Oh, wow.
And we have coverage of the markets that we want. And these people go to like 3 networking events a week kind of people, if not more.
Yeah.
To be able to like,
what are the mechanics of that? How do you incentivize them and stuff?
So originally we thought we're going to take a percentage of our carry and create a scout pool, and that you would get points for the gain on the deal that you introduced. There were people trying to get points for introducing deals that go south. And I thought, well, that's a bad incentive. And then we realized if somebody prevents us from making an investment, that's almost worth as much or more than having us make an investment. And then there's LP fundraising. And so LP fundraising is the easiest to share economics on. So we've got, if somebody brings LPs into the fund, that's very straightforward. That gets paid out at time zero. And then for sourcing deals, joining Zooms, doing DD, everyone's got a different superpower. I think that we should try and foster a community. And our hope is that over time, some of these people will join us full time. You know, as these are mostly much more senior people. So it could be GP, partner, principal, you know, investment associate.
Well, this was an amazing conversation. I could have talked to you for another hour. We didn't even get to most of what I had outlined, or let alone the rapid fire. Thank you so much for coming on, Andrew. This was amazing.
Brian, thanks for having you. Looking forward to doing more deals with you.
Yeah, we'll do it again. Thanks so much.
Bye for now.